And welcome back to Coast. Chad Lewis back with us. He was last with me a couple of years ago as we talked about the big muddy monster, like Monsters of Wisconsin. His latest work is called Lumberjack Creatures of the North Woods. He'll explain all of that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Chad Lewis with us. Seemed destined to write about lumberjack legends and lore. Born and raised in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, a town nicknamed Sawdust City. Why? Because of all the sawmills that once littered all the riverbanks. As a grade schooler, Chad took school field trips to the local Paul Bunyan Logging Camp Museum to learn about the town's logging history. After high school, he received his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He's an accomplished author. His latest work, Lumberjack Creatures of the North Woods. Chad, welcome back.
Greetings from the North Woods of Wisconsin, George.
And I love Wisconsin, by the way. What a great state, isn't it? I love those Midwestern-type states.
Yes, if people were not born in the Midwest, they love coming here. They love the people, the land, the culture. You just can't beat it.
By the way, the graphics on your cover of Lumberjack, fantastic. Who did that?
A friend of mine, Rick Fisk, who's done other covers on more of my supernatural or paranormal theme books, but I really wanted it to showcase that fun, whimsical Northwoods adventure that people think of when they think of heading up north.
And I got a kick out of your inscription to me, George, stay out of the Northwoods.
Well, a lot of the old lumberjacks would agree with that. They would tell you, stay out no matter what.
Let's set the stage for the logging industry, first of all. Is it still a big industry, or has it slowed down?
Well, it's nowhere near where it was in its heyday in the mid-1800s, when thousands of men up in the Northwoods would leave every winter and go to the bunkhouse and leave their families, their farms, everything behind, and basically spend several months in the bunkhouse cutting wood during the season to make enough money to save the family farm, or maybe have a heyday at one of the local river towns where they would spend their money as fast as they made it. But thousands, tens of thousands of these men, starting, of course, in Vermont and Maine, and then moving west to the Midwest with the big woods of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota.
For the money of those days, were they making good cash?
They were, especially if they were experienced. And the lumber industry was an equal opportunity employer. No matter your religion, your skin color, where you came from, the language you spoke, if you could do the job of the person next to you, you would get the same pay as that person got, which is why we have so many African-American lumberjacks, Native American lumberjacks. But, of course, the iconic image of the lumberjack is the tall, strapping, flannel-wearing Caucasian, even though there were so many people from other countries in the lumber camps. The old joke was that at night you could hear snoring in 10 different languages.
How did Paul Bunyan become such an institution?
Well, that's more of a modern thing. In the early days, Paul Bunyan was talked about for decades before anyone actually made it into the mainstream, if you will. Lumberjacks talked about Paul Bunyan, but they talked about him in ways that when researchers came, folklorists and sociologists came, what they found is that so many of the stories were racist, sexist, and very sexual, where they were afraid to print it because they would be fined by companies because it wasn't proper. So
right.
Many of the early Paul Bunyan stories were not recorded. Most of what we know of the Paul Bunyan legends came later, late 1800s, and then in print in the early 1900s. But Paul Bunyan was the most infamous lumberjack of all time, and every lumber camp would tell stories of how they worked with Paul and Babe in the big camp, and it was their favorite time.
In those early days, Chad, of course, they didn't have gas-powered saws or anything like that. What did they use, axes and handsaws? How did they get these trees down?
Exactly. It was the most dangerous job you could have in America. Imagine 100-foot trees weighing, you know, huge weight, saws, flying axes. So they would work brutal hours. They would work from what they called can't see to can't see. They'd be up and in the woods before sun came up, and they wouldn't finish until it was dark. So they would work all day long, and they were, it was so dangerous, obviously.
God.
And many of them passed away. They met their end at the lumber camp.
I wonder how many people got killed by falling trees and things like that.
And these were strong, sturdy, hardy men. If you got injured out in the woods, what they would usually do is plug the cut with some tobacco and try to stitch you up when you came back to camp. And if they couldn't, they would send you to a local hospital. But for the most part, you were expected to work unless you were missing a limb or something of that severity. So hundreds died every year, not only in the woods with falling trees and when they would stack these huge piles of wood to be hauled down to the rivers by the horses and oxen, but also the men that had to ride the rivers to get these logs to the lumber industry. They were drowned quite often, and many times their real name might not even be known.
Jeez.
They would just hang their boots on a tree as a memorial for the drowned lumberjack.
Or they'd get crushed between two logs or something.
Yes. And again, oftentimes there was no support for the family. The family might not even hear. You might be at a lumber camp and you might be known as Madison Bill, and they might not even know your real name or where you're from. So there was no payment sent to a family for those who met their watery graves.
When they got together after they worked, and probably before they passed out, did they tell tall tales?
This was their main source of entertainment. Imagine 14-hour day, you're done, you go back to the bunkhouse, which was set up almost like dorm rooms, where it would be a long building, and people would have a little cot, and there'd be maybe 30, 40 men in this room. The only exit being, of course, the one door and the stove for it to exit. So you can imagine the smell of the wet wool, the tobacco,
right,
the pipe smoke, and the men who haven't bathed in weeks.
Oh,
and that
God.
Was their main form of entertainment. They would sit around at night and tell tall tales and spin yarns.
And drink, probably, I guess, right?
Well, a lot of the lumber camps, probably for good reason, did not allow liquor in the lumber camps. So a lot of these men would go 3-4 months without a drink, which is one of the reasons why when they got out with their money in the spring, they headed to the nearest river town that were all too happy to take their money from them.
Amazing. So the stories that they would tell, were they some supernatural?
Yes. I mean, in amongst these lumberjack creatures, they would tell stories of what we would consider more traditional supernatural legends. Bigfoot, spook lights, will-o'-the-wisp, traditional ghost stories, witches, and the like. And of course, they didn't call it Bigfoot back then, but there were a lot of wild man or wild men stories of the lumber camps that would terrify these men. And again, these were men you wouldn't think would get spooked by anything, but I have many newspaper accounts of lumberjacks finding big footprints in the snow or the mud and being afraid that something supernatural was in the area.
And I am sure that with some of these tall tales, they tried to outdo each other, didn't they?
That was a competition. And the stories didn't take place like they do here with us in modern times. It would start with somebody telling a story, maybe the time they worked with Paul Bunyan up on the Onion River. And they would start telling the story, and maybe someone would jump in and say, "You're not doing it right. This is what really happened. I was there." And they try to one-up one another. And the stories were never told the same way twice. They were always morphing, evolving. And these were storytellers of great talent. They could keep the new greenhorns, the rookies, the young lumberjacks, on the edge of their bunks because they couldn't believe that this stuff was actually real. Because remember, back then, the big woods seemed anything was possible.
Right.
That they were never ending. There could be anything lurking in those woods.
And the many of these creatures that they talked about were pretty violent, weren't they?
They were. They were meant, if they happen in regular society, you would think that they were cautionary tales. Don't go down to the river. There's a sea serpent inhabiting it.
It's going to bite
away
you.
Yeah, stay away. You're going to drown. But they had no choice but to go into the woods. So when they talked about these creatures being responsible for death and dismemberment and misfortune of lumberjacks, it wasn't done as a cautionary tale. It was done to frighten people.
Interesting take. How did you decide to key in on lumberjack creature stories?
Growing up in the Midwest, I had always heard legends of these creatures. People would use them as their town mascot or marketing tools. And it wasn't until I was doing more traditional paranormal or supernatural when, believe it or not, people would contact me and say, how do I go about finding the Hodag? I'm really interested in it, and I have no idea where to start. And they were asking about all these lumberjack creatures, which I just assumed everybody took with a little wink and a nudge.
Mm-hmm.
But yet so many people claimed that they were still around. And not only that, they wanted to encounter them. So nothing had been done for many, many decades on these lumberjack creatures. So I thought they needed a fresh overview and more of a historical account of their origins rather than just the big yarns and the tall tales.
Most of the creatures they talked about were pretty dangerous, weren't they?
Yes, they could not only harm you, but often they had a vendetta against humans. And the reason for that is our encroachment in the woods. A lot of the lumber industry during this time was not like it is today. They weren't replanting. They weren't selective in their tree selection. They were clear-cutting everything. They go in and wipe a forest off the planet. And of course, that was the impetus for why these creatures were upset. We were coming into their area. We were taking their land. So oftentimes, they would look to harm the lumberjacks. For instance, there's one called the egg roll pelter. It was a baboon-looking creature that would sit up in the top of hollowed trees holding a huge log in its hand, making it look like it was just another limb of the tree. And when unsuspecting hikers or lumberjacks would come walking by with their eyes on the ground, making sure they don't trip and fall, the egg roll pelter would smash them with these logs.
Jeez.
And they would never return to the lumber camp.
Wow. He'd kill them.
Yeah, exactly, kill them. And in some instances, the animals not only killed them, but consumed them. There was this whirling wimpus creature, which was this big gorilla-looking creature that could spin so fast it would almost disappear with its long arms. And it would hit these lumberjacks and turn them into like a mucus. And then it would drink it like a soup. Very gruesome, very gory things, not kid-friendly of the time.
Hey, Chad, how many of these stories were myths, and how many do you think were real?
Great question. Well, as of today, researchers of the era had collected over 100 of these legends of creatures, different creatures that were said to lurk in the Northwoods. And many of them are obviously 100% fictional. The hoop snake, a snake that can bite its own tail, turning into a hoop, and then chase you down a hill.
Is that what I see on the cover?
Yes. The hoop snake has a venomous tail, but it could move as a hoop going down a hill, reaching speeds of 100 miles per hour, and then smash that stinger into you. So things like that obviously are not about, but people still have accounts of them. I have many newspaper accounts of people telling journalists that they encountered these hoop snakes. But then the other creatures that seem to fit more in, like I said, the Bigfoot or the sea serpent or the spook lights, these mysterious will-o'-the-wisp that would appear, they seem to be happening still today. And they fall more into the category of cryptozoology or the general paranormal.
Where did the jackalope come into in terms of it's not really a scary creature?
Jackalope seems to be more one of the friendly creatures. And anyone's familiar with lumberjack creatures, they're probably familiar with the jackalope. If you stop at any tourist gift shop or you go out west, you'll see jackalope replicas on sale, and you can pick them up, and they're basically a rabbit-looking creature with antlers on them. And they started out as a fun thing where the cowboys sitting around the fire after a dusty day on the range would sing songs. And the lumberjacks would also be sawing when they would hear the jackalope singing or harmonizing with them. And they were thought to be a harmless creature, fun, cuddly, very cool. They wouldn't hurt you like a lot of these other creatures would. And the lumberjacks and the cowboys would lure in these jackalopes with alcohol, whiskey specifically. It was said that you could trap them and train them if you had enough alcohol.
How many different creatures did these lumberjacks create?
We know of well over 100 of these, and some are pretty obscure and some are site-specific. They might only happen in a lumber area in Maine or in Oregon. But many of these, well over 100 of them, were known to roam the entire United States. And even though the book I did was based on the Northwoods, every state has a Northwoods, whether you're in the Northwoods of Florida, which is not really a Northwoods for those of us up here, but it is for that state. And logging was done eventually in nearly every state outside of North Dakota, because Paul Bunyan had already logged it.
Is the book based on myth or real stories?
I think a bit of both. And I say that kind of with some hesitation because some of these creatures have modern sightings. People actually believe they've seen them, but for the most part, they're mythical creatures. They only existed, as far as we know, in the imagination of the lumberjacks who created them. But were they picking up and telling real stories along with some of these yarns? Because when you read some of these accounts, they match up pretty closely with modern day accounts of other cryptids that people are encountering. So I think part of the fun and also part of the difficulty is sorting fact from fiction. When you have these lumberjacks who are known for telling yarns, how do you know when they were getting serious and telling real stories?
Were some of these stories based on what do you think might have been fact as opposed to fiction, and then they just embellished it a little bit?
I think so, and the jackalope would be another instance of that, another great example of rabbits having a virus that causes a tumor-like growth that to the layperson looks like horns or antlers growing out of their head. And many believe that was the origin. People would see these rabbits infected with this disease, and that was the impetus for the jackalope. So a lot of these creatures were based on things that would happen. Now, at night, you're sitting in the bunkhouse, completely dark outside, the winds whistling, blizzards blowing through. You hear trees cracking, limbs breaking, all sorts of noises. You had to explain that. That wasn't just the weather. That was the splinter cat jumping into a tree with its anvil-like head smashing it, looking for food.
As they pull their covers over their head. We're going to come back with more, Chad, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Chad Lewis. We're going to take calls with Chad next hour as we're talking about his latest work, Lumberjack Creatures of the North Woods. What are the North Woods, Chad?
I think the North Woods, for many people, signifies heading up to an area with a lot of lumber. No matter what state you're in, there's that vacation spot, usually up north, where things move a bit slower. It's a bit more wild, a bit more spread out, and people feel like it was when the old growth was still in America before a lot of it was cut down. They still feel like the big woods, that sense of adventure, camping, cabins, campfires. You know, that whole feel of when you're a kid and just the idea of heading up to a Northwoods retreat, that's the Northwoods of America.
Would you say the lumberjacks of today continue this tradition of myth stories?
Well, I think in some aspects they do, but the lumberjacks today, they operate so much different than the old days, where a lot of lumber organizations and operations today, it's several people in a crew. They'll head out and they'll be working separately in an area. And when they finish, they'll go home, or at worst, they'll go to their hotel room separately. You don't have that community that's built around the bunkhouse, the cook shanty, and where there's nothing else to do but to tell stories at night when you're sitting around with your pipe smoking and your chewing tobacco, that there was nothing else. So today it's much different. So we don't get these robust stories because it's not part of modern culture to the extent it was when tens of thousands of men were employed in this operation.
Now, for yourself personally, what great stories did you hear? Did you condense them all for your book, or how did you handle that?
Well, I chose the 20 creatures I wanted to focus on that I thought were the most interesting, the most bizarre, the most unbelievable in some regards. But I also wanted to put some type of citation with it. When it was old newspapers would cover a lot of these lumberjack stories. And throughout America, we have a series of old lumberjack museums that you can go to and see all the tools, usually the implements that were used during the logging industry. But more and more of these are being turned into folklore museums where you can hear the stories, see the clothing, find the culture of these legends. And I think that's the important part of it. Of course, you know, my mind goes right to the fantastical creatures because that's the part I love most. But a lot of people end up loving other aspects of the lumberjack lore. For instance, lumberjacks, when they went out for breakfast at the cook shanty, they were not allowed to talk during breakfast at all.
Jeez.
Because if you were not talking, you were not eating. And they needed to eat as fast as they could.
And get back to work.
All those calories, yeah, and get out in the big woods. Many times, lunch was brought on site because they didn't want to waste the time going back to the cook shanty to eat. So a lot of people love the idea of, you know, 100 lumberjacks in this huge room eating, and not one sound except their chomping could be heard.
That's amazing. Now, with some of these, how did you weigh the fact and the fiction, or did it matter?
For this book, and I put it in the preface or the author's note that, you know, I'm presenting these, not verifying them for their credibility. I'm leaving that up to the reader, the witness, and so forth. And I wanted to have fun with these. So there's a story of two men out west that created the jackalope. They said they made it taxidermist. They created it. I didn't put that in the book because I didn't think it was as fun as the legend of the jackalope, you know, breeding during thunderstorms at night in the Dakotas. So a lot of it is done with a wink, but then there's a lot of it where you think this sounds very close to what I could find on Coast to Coast AM.
That's right.
These stories are very similar of people seeing these wild men or these weird lights in the woods, which of course were not UFOs back then. They were spook lights, will-o'-the-wisp, gases, they would call them. So a lot of this is very eerily similar to what we have today.
What's the importance of saving and preserving this kind of folklore?
I think today, when the lumber industry certainly will never be what it was, it's just adapted too much, that people have forgotten about it. Years ago, I talked to many people who remember as kids sneaking down to the lumber mills to see their grandpa or their uncle working in the mills, and they would watch all this lumber going through and all the economic benefits of it. And that's all been gone. People just don't have that memory anymore. And I think often with that, these stories erode as well. These legends, these creatures, they only exist in the memories of old-time lumberjacks. And I thought that they're so unique and so puzzling and so fun that they had to be saved. And that was one of my goals. And this is by no means a big tome. It's more of a monograph of a specific smaller book than most of mine, because I wanted it to be accessible to people that might not even be interested in this kind of stuff. They might be on vacation with their family and say, this would make a good campfire story. And that's who I was trying to target, because people in the field, they're going to be aware of a lot of these stories. And I wanted the people that, the old saying, don't preach to the choir type thing.
Let's talk about a few of the creatures that are highlighted in your book. What is the Snowwasset?
Yeah, the Snowwasset is a creature that was left behind when the glaciers came through. And it's pure white, and it hibernates all summer, spring, and fall. It only comes out in the winter after the first heavy snow. And by all accounts, it's somewhere between the size of a polar bear and a sea lion. And it's all white, which means you cannot see it. It's a terrible hunter and if you're the prey, because it eats anything, and you don't know where it's going to pop up. It moves beneath the snow, and it listens and feels for movement on top of the snow, and then it comes out and devours whatever's there, whether it's a turkey, a moose, or a stray hiker. And the only way to avoid it, of course, is to wait for the winter of the blue snow, when the temperature's so bad, people are cursing a blue streak so much it turns the snow blue, and you can see it white against the blue, or just simply don't go in the woods in the winter.
Do any of these creatures have anything to do with people that have gone crazy or insane or wild out in the woods, or are they all animals?
I think most of them are more indigenous animals that seem to have a weird origin story. They may have, like the snow snake, they may have came over from Siberia. And, of course, they're only around in the winter as well. But then there are other creatures I'm not so sure of, like the hide behind. A creature that hides behind you in the woods no matter what you do. If you're standing there in the woods, it will be behind you. If you jump 180 degrees, it will be behind you. And it is said to be so good at hiding that nobody has ever lived to tell about their sighting of it, because it's so good at hiding, it can hide behind itself. And I think that might have been on that wild man story, that crazed, maybe alcohol-fueled lumberjack losing his mind going into the woods, hiding and lurking, may have had origins in with the hide behind.
Any surprises for you, Chad, while you were doing the book?
I was surprised at the mix of how a lot of these stories were dangerous and deadly, but some were fun and friendly, and some were a means of being clever to explain away a situation. One of the creatures is this creature, it's called a beesquito, and it was said that Paul Bunyan was having trouble with the Northwoods mosquitoes. They were gigantic.
Oh, that's on your cover too, right?
Yes, the creature would come down and pluck lumberjacks from the camp and fly away with them.
Oh, jeez.
So Paul wanted to get rid of these, and he remembered he had a similar problem down south with bumblebees, these huge, giant hornets of sorts. So he had his men go down and bring some of these hornets up to the Northwoods to kill the mosquitoes. But instead, they got along swimmingly. They started marrying and mating and produced an offspring that had a stinger on each end so it could get you coming or going. So that was the cleverness of the lumberjack, that this half mosquito, half bee that had a stinger on both ends that would come and terrorize people. And that was mainly to explain away a lot of the deadly, terrible pests of the Northwoods.
I was going to say, there's got to be a basis of some truth behind these stories.
Yeah, these black flies that would terrorize the lumberjacks more than any living creature out there. And it was meant to explain away a lot of these scenarios. As I mentioned earlier, this splinter cat, when trees would be toppled over in storms and heavy snow, they blamed it on this creature hunting at night. And many lumberjacks were said to have perished because the splinter cat was of low intelligence, and it would jump from a tree with its huge iron-like head and smash right into the chest of a lumberjack.
I love this name, the goofus bird. What kind of creature is that?
One-of-a-kind bird. Not only does it build its nest upside down, but it likes to fly backwards. And a lot of newspapers said it does that because it doesn't care where it's going. It only cares where it has been. So it flies backwards. It's a huge turkey-like creature with very colorful feathers. And it's a one-of-a-kind bird. And I think that illustrates that the lumberjacks weren't just mammals. The creatures weren't just mammals that were out there. They had all kinds of flying animals, animals in the water, because even though you were cutting wood, you were in the sky, you were around lakes, so you had to come up with these creatures that could inhabit every scenario you came across.
Did these individuals, these lumberjacks that told these stories in the wee hours, do you think they saw something and then embellished it or said what they think they saw, or do you think they totally made these up?
I think it was a combination. One of the more infamous creatures is the hodag. And it's one of those where I still, as I mentioned, get people saying, I want to go see it. Where can I find it? I need to know more.
Right.
And we know that stories were circulating in lumber camps for many years, but it wasn't until Eugene Shepherd, a timber cruiser and Rhinelander, said he went out and captured one of these things. And not only did he capture it, he put it on display at fairs and carnivals, and then eventually in his home in Rhinelander in a big pit where he would have his kids down there moving wires and pulleys for this hodag. And eventually it was discovered to be a hoax, his hodag. And he said, yes, I hoaxed this one because they're too dangerous for me to actually capture. That they're out there, I've seen them, but I couldn't capture it without risking my life, so I created one. And more people showed up when they knew it was a hoax and paid money to see how he had done it than when they thought it was a real, live, captured hodag.
Tell us more about this hoop snake that you mentioned earlier.
Hoop snake's great because it seems to get anybody. It doesn't have a preference on who it chases, lumberjack, hiker, lost the camper. It goes after everybody, and it can come in many varieties. And the scary thing is, by all accounts, it looks like a normal snake, except for the fact that it can grab its tail and move at fast rates and come after you. And there are many stories of pioneers, just regular farmers, day laborers, people walking to the general store, when they would see a big dust up coming down the road and they saw a hoop snake coming toward them. So they would advise one another, if you saw a hoop snake, if you could, you would want to run between a fence because they couldn't get through it. Two, you could jump between the circle and it would confuse the hoop snake enough. It would lose its concentration and fall over. Or you could climb a tree, because the hoop snake would not be able to, obviously, go up a tree. So not only did they have these creatures, not only did they fear them, they had ways that if you were clever enough, you could outsmart them. And that was a source of pride for a lot of lumberjacks, of being clever, being creative. And they would have competitions to see who could do that the best.
We're going to take your calls next hour with Chad Lewis, so jump on board. And if you want to share some of your stories, you can do that or just ask him a question. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His latest book is called Lumberjack Creatures of the North Woods. Where do people get your book, Chad?
Anywhere books are sold. You can get it signed from my website or anywhere online.
And I've got to sign one.
Yes, and I hope you heed that advice.
The Lake Monsters of Wisconsin was one of your earlier books. Was that based on real experience?
Yes. That was accounts of over 40 different lakes, rivers, and streams in Wisconsin that were said to or still are believed to have a sea serpent in them, including one where there's a $50,000 reward for its capture.
On the back of this book, Lumberjack Creatures of the North Woods, there's another title that says A Family Guide to the Creatures of the North Woods. Tell me the difference.
Yes. Well, I wanted this to be family-oriented, and because I wanted to get kids involved. One is it gets them into the field. It gets them into history and gets them into legends. And kids love creatures. But I wanted to keep it true to its original form. So some of the stories are bordering on, you know, maybe teenagers. But most of them are family-friendly, talking about these creatures around the fire. And I really, again, pinpointing that tourist, that person that may not set out to buy a book on the supernatural or paranormal. But if you can hook them in these kind of peripheral interests, that's my goal in the paranormal now. I've done over 20 books on standard ghosts, UFOs, monsters, and I love it. I'll keep doing it. But I'm trying to kind of reach those boundaries on the spectrum of the paranormal that aren't covered as much.
Chad, let's take some calls with you when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.